Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host and founder of Product Innovation Educators, where product managers learn to become product masters. Product portfolio management is concerned with selecting the right products to develop, making the involved trade-off decisions, and generally maximizing the value of the product portfolio. It's an important activity in organizations that have more than one product, but it's also an activity that doesn't get the attention it always deserves, and it's actually a difficult one to learn about. I sought to find an expert who could help us better understand what is really involved in product portfolio management. And that expert is Carrie Nayalis. She's the MPD solution evangelist for PlanView. Carrie began her career at PlanView implementing portfolio management solutions and training clients around the world. She clearly knows what is involved in product portfolio management. She is also well versed on many other new product development topics and is an active blogger, public speaker, and guest lecturer. You can find the summary and transcript of our discussion at TheEverydayInnovator.com/084. My discussion with Carrie was a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Carrie. Thanks so much for joining us today, being part of the Everyday Innovator podcast.
I am thrilled to talk about portfolio management every day.
I'm glad you're here. So my first encounter with you was a year or two ago on a webinar that you did on the topic of portfolio management. And I'm so glad to be able to track you down and that you were able to help me out by sharing with the Everyday Innovators some information on portfolio management.
Pleasure, definitely.
You have deep roots in product management and topic of portfolio management. So let's just start with the basics. Let's get our hands around a definition. What is portfolio management?
Sure. So portfolio management in general is really the discipline and framework for applying your two most precious resources, your people and your money, to get the greatest value out of your investment. So if you think about portfolio management like you do with your 401k, it's the same concept, but you're applying it to your innovation, really about making trade-off decisions and balance decisions to really achieve your corporate or innovation strategies.
I like the 401k analogy. And frankly, I don't put those two together. But I think when people just hear portfolio management out of context, right, we often think about a retirement, you know, kind of portfolio.
Absolutely.
And that has more of a gut reaction, right? Which is how I really believe as product managers and leaders of companies, we should be thinking about our product portfolio, because we're taking the same sort of bets, you know, in a sense, and hoping to optimize, you know, some return with what's
That's
in that
right.
portfolio.
With risk tolerance,
yeah.
you know, and considerations and also balancing a couple of things. You know, when you're talking about your 401k, you're talking about your timeline, your risk tolerance, mm-hmm. how much you're investing. Are you diversified? Are you balanced based on your age? It is the same thing. But when you're talking about it in terms of innovation and product development and new product development, it's really about, okay, how does this align to our strategy? Do we have the resources? Do we have permission to play here? Will it drive the revenue? I know a lot of people get a little caught up in the revenue side and don't always look at some of the other aspects mm-hmm. like they would for their 401k, but they really need to look at it from a broad perspective and make sure they achieve that balance across things like breakthrough innovation versus line mm-hmm. extensions, you know, talking about risk.
So when it comes to setting up a portfolio of products in a company, you just address some of the goals. And that's one thing I wanted to hit on too, which was, what are the goals companies have, right? And so you mentioned balance is one. What
yeah.
would be some examples that they're balancing over, like breakthrough innovation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really about value maximization. So that's what Dr. Cooper and Dr. Edgett of StageGate fame really talk about it. And I love kind of that phrase of value maximization, because by the way, that's why we're all in business. And so really being able to kind of drive into that and get the biggest bang for your buck is really key. And so that's kind of the main goal. But portfolio management just kind of provides some structure around that and some discipline and some best practices to really make sure that you're looking at all of those aspects, especially the resource side. What I see, we do a ton of research, and what I see so often, unfortunately, the biggest pain point is too much work for my resources. And that's actually a portfolio management problem, because you're looking at one single project or product myopically and saying, this is a good idea, without the context of a larger or broader portfolio. Mm-hmm. And so you're missing that perspective of how does this one idea fit in the greater good? You know, do we have multiple products in that space? Will that cannibalize something? Are we hitting one market too hard and have a gap in another one? So it's all of that in play. And with products, it's really fun and fascinating. And this podcast could be days long because I could geek out about it with you for a long time. But I think that really...
I'll order pizza in for us. We're all set.
So, I mean, really being able to look at your product lines and your brands and really understand what are you trying to accomplish with those, you know, and really then designing portfolios to achieve those goals.
Right. And in that, I was thinking how we leverage our resources and use those valuable resources. And too many times companies have too many projects going on at once, too many things in the portfolio.
Yeah, the they say yes to everything.
Yeah. And the timeline issue is important too. About, you know, often we might have projects that are important, are valuable, but compared to what we're already doing.
That's right. Right.
If all we have resources for are to do 10 on a scale of 1 to 10 projects, right? 10 number 10s. We'd be really happy, right? But if a 9 comes along, we say, oh, but that's such a great opportunity for us. Well, it's a 9. It's down one notch. And if we don't have resources, we don't have resources.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've probably have seen this. It seems like the timeline consequences get underestimated, right?
Absolutely. And resource capacity.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, I think they rely on heroics amongst the project teams because they've been able to do it and they wear their capes and they want to serve the company. Right. And that's awesome, but it gets exhausting and it's not sustainable. And so what happens is you say yes to all of those ideas on the front end and things get clogged and priorities are unclear and nothing makes it out the other end for delivering products to market.
Right.
And that's a really painful thing. And resource management and capacity planning is really at the heart of it. And it's something that a lot of organizations forget. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, most often it's not a situation where one resource can be exchanged for another. In some cases, that's true. But in product organizations, you can't swap a packaging person for a nutritionist in CPG, you know? Yeah. And so if you've got a limit on one of those resources, that dictates how much throughput you can get with your portfolio.
Yeah. And throughput's really important. You know, if we are
absolutely,
if we push all these projects into the portfolio that we think have value, but we're looking at, you know, 2 years to maybe get something out, where instead if we focused our resources on the most important thing, we could start generating revenue on something strategically important to us in 6 months. Well, what isn't that a better use? You know, is this lean concept of what do we reduce so we can maximize our return on what's most important?
Absolutely. And I think that's really a scary concept for a lot of companies. You know, a lot of people like to talk about lean, but one company that I know, they're a heavy manufacturer, they actually would, they have made a conscious decision in their R&D PMO to really do less, but do it accurate and on-time delivery so that their revenue is more predictable. So they might actually have the capacity to do 10, but they actually may choose 8 or 9.
Right.
And make sure that they hit those dates every single time so that their revenue targets are perfectly spot on.
And everything is more predictable, which makes everything work better together.
Yeah.
Right. Good. Okay. So there's different ways to construct portfolios I've come across. And and you talked about balance, right? And the things that we want to balance. So share how companies are going about constructing portfolios, what you see used out there, and maybe some recommendations for what to do.
Sure. This is one of those questions where it depends.
Sure.
There's no one right answer. And, you know, it really does vary pretty widely by the industry that you're in. If you're in automotive or pharma, which have really long cycle times in products, versus a CPG company that has extremely short cycle times in being able to churn those things out, with technology being on that end as well. That really kind of changes things up. In most cases, the portfolio is kind of a mix of things. And the awesome thing is that you can have multiple portfolios with that project showing up in different ways, so that different people in the organizations can see it the way that they want to and they think about it.
Yeah, the way that matters to them.
Yeah, exactly. So there are companies that certainly do kind of a top-down portfolio based on their strategy, with programs at the top. And then from those programs really come down into the projects and products that they want to launch.
Can you give an example of what a program might be like, or a top-down strategy?
Sure. It may be to deliver existing products to a new market.
Okay.
So they've decided to enter this new market, and we want to grow revenue by X percent into this new market. But we want to be able to determine that and do it with existing products, whether that's a slight change in packaging, a slight change in marketing, those types of things. Mm-hmm. But it's a conscious decision at the executive level that that's the path we need to take in order to grow.
Right.
On the flip side of that, there are kind of the bottom-up portfolios, and those are organizations that are really, and there can be a balance and a play and a discussion between the two of those, but on the bottom-up examples, that might be a situation where product features are really kind of driving that particular product, and customer requests are driving that. Think about a lot of companies that are B2B and are taking orders. You know, that's really difficult to say, here are the things that are on the shelf. It's not like that. It's a custom type development. And so those things kind of come bottom up, and you can still have a strategy, but they're coming in kind of from the bottom and not from the top down. But there are also dozens of other portfolios. You might have a portfolio by region. You might have a portfolio by brand. You might have a portfolio by product line. So all of those different things, so that, again, everybody kind of gets to see that information the way that they, in their viewpoint of the world, and how they want to do portfolio management, and also reporting and analytics.
Okay. So when companies are younger, they start out with that single product, they grow over time, they have the multiple products going on. And at some point they start feeling this pain of managing, and where do we put our resources? Which ones are more important? And they start constructing a portfolio. Do you see them, or do you recommend that, you know, we start with a strategy driven approach to construct it? We go a little bit, maybe for some, it's uncomfortable, loosey-goosey, you know, bottom up, or a mixture of those things, right? And I focus on those two because it sounded like the other, you know, region, brand, product line are just slices through the portfolio to reflect, you know, a manager's what they need to see of the information, right?
Yeah. I think first, number one is awareness in portfolio management. They understand the pain, but they don't always know what the pain is. Sometimes they add throw resources at it. And it's interesting that I found, so I've been in portfolio management for 18 years and grew up in the IT space. And IT was kind of the first department in the company to use portfolio management as a discipline, because the business was like beating on them saying, hey, we're giving you a bunch of money, Mr. Cost Center. What are we getting out of that? I want some say in that. And, you know, IT was like, hey, I only have so many resources and so much money that you're giving me. What do you want to prioritize? Mm-hmm. And product portfolio management kind of has really taken on that discipline over the last 10 years. And so this whole concept of the stage gate kind of approach. Interestingly enough, and I'll get to your question in a second, sidebar on the stage gate stuff, it's interesting because stage gate is a traditionally product development methodology. IT starting to use it. So it was like this cross-pollination of disciplines and methodologies that are happening, because, you know, IT with their development of an application, really, you know, they just kind of moved forward with it. When they said go, you just went to the finish.
Right.
Whereas there's so much development cost to take a product to market. You know, one of my customers, they said plain and simple, it takes them $25 million to take one product to market. And so they have to be very fastidious in each of the gates in order to make sure they're making the right decision all along. And they may kill it at any one of those points.
Sure.
So when you're talking about, you know, kind of taking that leap into portfolio management from kind of single project execution, number one is awareness, to know that there is a discipline. IT is very used to using software as a tool to solve problems. Product development is less aware of using technology to solve such a problem. So knowing that there's portfolio management as a discipline, number one, and that there's tools to back it up is very powerful. The second thing is really kind of establishing the rules that you want to play by and what portfolio management is trying to achieve in the organization. Because it's not just about visibility in that portfolio. It is, what do we want to be able to achieve? So if they can like kind of define why they're establishing that portfolio and kind of establishing that discipline of portfolio management, that's a real key in getting going. And I think that my personal opinion, I think a lot of the top down works well because that's a hard discipline to push up. So if, you know, for the organizations who are really trying to step into portfolio management, getting management on board, having that leadership, having the participation, because they're the biggest customers of this. I mean, they get the greatest benefit out of being able to leverage portfolio management. So getting them engaged with that and really kind of stating what we're trying to accomplish and the trade-off decisions with that is really key.
I would think as companies are growing in their number of products and feeling that pain, you know, resource management constraints, that the top-down approach would add that necessary structure to actually deal with the problem, right?
Precisely.
Because the bottom-up approach, you might just kind of continue doing what you were doing before and responding to those customer requests and not really looking at an integrated portfolio.
Right.
And sometimes we have to do that, right? It's the, let's put it in a process, figure out the process. Once we have
and
that working.
And then get them on board.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And then we can figure out how to tailor it to, you know, better meet our needs. It seems like, quick sidebar, you know, for the agile community, when established companies are bringing in that discipline, too often they start with wanting to create something custom for them. It's like, well, you're never going to know what agile is without actually doing it, you know, so do it on a project and then figure out what works and doesn't work for you.
Yeah. But boy, is that talk about a big cultural shakeup. That can be a doozy. Yeah. We've helped a couple of companies through that transition from waterfall to agile and, you know, heads explode. What do you mean I don't get to control the scope? What?
Right. How does that work? Right. And the same is true here for portfolio management. If you're putting in a top-down strategy-driven approach that says, so in my mind, you can help clarify this for me. You know, I might have like, you know, four buckets that I'm going to allocate different kinds of projects to. Right. And so I picked four out of my hat and I'm not sure if I can come up with them now, but let's say there's the incremental improvement. So we're going to have some products that we just are looking for the next revision, next version for our customers. There's going to be some things that are new products for us, but maybe not new to the marketplace that come along that we want to play with. Maybe if we're a fast follower kind of company and we tend to be more market reactive, we know that we're expecting a competitor to do something and we already have a bucket set up to, you know, follow their actions and, you know, maybe a group of competitors sort of thing. But we get these buckets established for what we're going to do, right?
Yep.
Is that the kind of idea for a top-down approach?
Absolutely. And thinking about proactively, it's like, okay, what, and especially, you know, add to that another bucket for innovation.
Yeah.
A lot of people like to talk about innovation, and I like to pick on those people, unfortunately. But it's like, I really believe in the throughput of things. And I think that really allocating a portion of the pie to that breakthrough side of things,
right,
and really being committed to that and understanding that that is not a, you know, a line extension is something that we're fairly confident in, mm-hmm. and we can predict that. But breakthrough innovations are much harder. But really committing to innovation and really being able to take a slice of the pie, the people and the money to dedicate to that is really very key.
Right. And another level of that, can I break that down into two groups, right? There's the let's do something new for us, this breakthrough innovation for our customers that kind of, you know, it makes, we collectively will say that's a big stretch for us, but we can see it making sense, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other bucket is the whole Google X type moonshot project that you say, we're not sure what kind of company we're going to be in 10 years. Let's start making some bets about what the future might look like and think areas we can play. And a lot of companies can't do that, right? They're not prepared for that. But I think it's useful to have that, you know, mindset in place. Like the world's going to look different in 10 years. And we should at least be thinking about what are we doing today that might play there.
Yeah, and I'm seeing a big trend in, I was just a moderator at the Front End of Innovation.
What a great conference.
It was, in Boston. And so I monitored a track that had a lot of discussions on innovation labs. Mm-hmm. And it takes in a really amazing culture to make that kind of investment into those moonshot projects. And also, I think there's somewhere in between, too, of things that are really innovative within our permission to play, mm-hmm. you know, that aren't necessarily, you know, this is 20 years from now kind of a perspective. Mm-hmm. So I think there's all kinds of levels of that.
Yeah, but having some recognition in the portfolio of those expectations, and even if it's just agreement to, you know, these are the things we care about and where we're going to play today, where we're going to put our emphasis. And, you know, maybe it's even just 10% on what might be the radical for us, not the moonshot stuff, but just the, well, this would be new for us. Let's, you know, allocate and some effort there.
It's true R. You know, we talk about R&D all the time, research and development, but you know, true research without the expectation of this is going to produce revenue in 2 years. You know, those innovation labs are really targeted at true R research.
Okay. Something that is a little bit further out. So in actually constructing a portfolio, if it's going to be top down, are companies putting specific percentages of where they're going to spend resources? And are there also timelines associated with this? How do we physically build a portfolio?
Sure. So yes and yes. They do typically kind of categorize based on whatever makes sense for their organization. And there are some trends like per vertical on what makes sense or what companies typically do. Really being able to set those percentages of the pie and how they're going to allocate resources and money. In fact, one of my favorite reports, and I actually stole it from Dr. Cooper, or maybe it was Dr. Edgett, but it is the most simple report on the planet. And it says everything about portfolio management. The first report, or it's what, three pie charts.
Okay.
Nothing fancy, no bubble charts, you know, no moving sliders or anything crazy like that. It's three pie charts. The first pie chart is your number of projects by each of those categories. So it's just a count.
Okay.
The second pie chart is how many resources by count are dedicated to those projects that are in that category.
Okay.
The third pie chart is the amount of revenue or margin or value or whatever you use for financial measure based on those same slices of pie. So here's a great example. So I say that I've got 100 projects in my pie chart, and 10% of them are allocated to our incremental, as you suggested. And it's interesting because we have like 50% of our resources working on that 10% of incremental projects. That seems a little off. And then I go over to the third pie chart that talks about the revenue, and I'm only getting 5% of the total revenue forecast from those incremental. Whacked.
Right.
It is the simplest vision to know whether things, when we talk about balance, that's what we're talking about. And it's such a simple thing. You can do that in Excel tomorrow, you know, and really be able to understand just whatever those categories are. Count of projects or products, count of resources, and revenue or value of some kind, benefit.
That makes the picture real clear, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? When we see things
out of whack like that, you go, what are we doing spending these resources on the low revenue producers? right?
Yes.
Which relates...
See, you get me all excited now,
This
Chad.
Is great.
All hyped up about it.
And listeners, sorry, we might pull down a few tangents as we go, but this is really important information. Before I forget, Cooper and Edgett are really good at sharing a lot of their papers for free off of their company site. Do you know if this one's available?
I don't know that one is. That's actually from their summit. But anybody could email me and I can send them a quick screenshot. It's just carrie@planb.com. But
cool. And if you have a screenshot, I'll include it in the show notes. So it's there too.
Definitely, people.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
So as part of this, when we're seeing things out of balance, a lot of times as companies build up products, right, we have these SKUs, right, the individual products that we maintain. And they build up over time, and we might not necessarily keep track of the ones that aren't really generating revenue anymore. And they're a drag on the company, right?
Yep.
I haven't seen that. I see that addressed when it comes to managing the product lifecycle of an individual product and that we need to retire and discontinue products. But I haven't seen it addressed well as part of a portfolio management approach. Where does this fit into portfolio management in terms of we should retire products that aren't making us money anymore?
So, the whole concept of the growth share matrix from Boston Consulting Group, where they've got the stars and the cash cows and the question marks and the dogs, those are those dogs that aren't performing well.
Right.
It actually is a piece of portfolio management to really be able to understand those categorizations. We've got it in our base tool just for that reason, so that you can see that balance, so that you can understand here are the dogs that aren't performing that we need to take off of the shelf. And by the way, if you're a CPG company of any kind, or even maybe even a technology company, shelf space is life.
Right.
And when you've got an underperforming product that's taking up space and not performing, you have to make those hard decisions to end of life it and be able to do that. And it's a little information to kind of see that and really be able then to execute the work necessary to be able to take that product off the market.
Yeah, they all create drag on the organization, right? And like the shelf space makes it, you see that, If you have things in inventory and they're not moving, you over time, you recognize this is a problem. We're wasting resources here. I think even for companies that are doing a virtual product, software that's being distributed through the cloud or cloud services, we still have the support that goes on with that. We have technology debt in the code base. And over time, all this becomes more burdensome as time goes on if we're not actually reducing things. And I give credit to organizations. Apple does this occasionally in their software. There's some other companies out there that are pretty good about actually removing features that just don't get used, right? It's like, why continue incurring that debt maintaining the products if they're not being used?
That's right. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage because inside of that company, that's somebody's baby.
Right.
Having been a product manager for 7 years, I had to kill one of my babies, even though that sounds awful and graphic. But it's something
Different
that you context. Love. Yes, indeed. But, and people get a little upset about that word kill, but it needs to be such a strong word because if left to languish, and the same is true for zombie projects.
Right.
If left to language, it will continue to suck resources and money.
Yeah.
And you have to make that kind of hard decision to be able to gain back those resources and money and apply them to something more effective.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard as a product manager to be able to kind of make that decision, but it's so necessary. I went to a conference. It was a Frost and Sullivan Growth and Innovation Conference. And one of the guys spoke about actually having a funeral for that product that needs to die, giving a eulogy, the whole nine yards. I wrote a blog about it because it just cracked me up. And I'm like, the conference was in New Orleans. I'm like, it needs to be a jazz funeral. it's the sad jazz going to the funeral. And we're so sad. We learned a lot. We made some money. And, we're able to apply these learnings. And then it's happy jazz celebrating all of the great things that everybody did.
Absolutely. It's funny you say that. I worked for a company that they had literally a physical graveyard out by the break courtyard, right, where you could go have lunch with little tombstones for dead products. And the point was not to be morbid anyway, but the point was to, and I'm actually not sure the culture took this in all that well, but the point was we need to have cultures that recognize the value in discontinuing products and killing off products that don't have any business being in the marketplace.
And projects.
Exactly. As they
and
go on.
And that's one of the benefits of portfolio management, is really being able to see that. What I see so often too is especially in large organizations where there's multiple divisions or there have been a bunch of acquisitions, they have no idea how much duplication they have. That, you know, totally different teams on different continents are working on the exact same thing. Right. And all of the money that's being invested off of that duplicate, and it could have been prevented because that visibility that comes with portfolio management kind of brings that to the surface. It's like, what are we even doing? We approved two projects that are the exact same thing, but because those groups are siloed, we had no visibility into it.
Which for large organizations makes the case for having a centralized portfolio management activity as opposed to maybe by business unit or region.
That's right. And you can have individual kind of business unit kind of leadership or little PMOs, but the reporting has to come to a pinnacle so that you can take the lessons learned from each of the groups and apply them, and then also to avoid that duplicate and also to share resources. There's so much benefit in that.
Okay. So a lot of things we started talking about, you know, we went from setting up the portfolio, maybe using a top-down approach and bucketing, you know, based on company strategy and how we want to grow. And now we've been talking about, you know, how do we monitor and control this thing, right? So what are the recommendations or what you see companies doing around that? Are they, you know, senior executive team meeting periodically? How does this happen?
Yeah, so it kind of depends again on the business and the frequency, but they are establishing some kind of a project and portfolio management office is a really common theme that I see. Even though in R&D, sometimes PMO is a bad word, so they call them centers of excellence, which is really fascinating to me. But having a place for the discipline, for the people, process, and tools to manage the discipline associated with all of that is a really big benefit. It doesn't have to be a large team, but that there's ownership and their sole purpose is to serve the business. They are not decision makers. Mm-hmm. They are not the ones who are dictating. They are not the ones prioritizing. It's still the gatekeepers as part of the commercialization process. They are the ones to support the entire process.
I like this take center of excellence. I've come across that also. And
yeah.
I don't know if PMO is just
organization. I assure you that it is a bad word in some cases.
Exactly.
Like, it incites like,
yeah. And I think
that's an IT thing.
Right. Yeah. You know, companies maybe have tried it and it didn't work for them. And like, let's not use that or something. Right. We can pick any term and there's always the advocates, you know, and those against it. So they're really just being kind of the trying to be the independent perspective on what's going on in the portfolio.
And serving up data.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So who's likely involved in actually doing that work? You probably don't have junior people being responsible for this, do you?
As far as
being on that center of excellence team, you know.
Yeah, it's a mix. There are usually some process rock stars in there that really can articulate the process and visualize it and train on it, get it repeatable. So there's some process ninjas in that mix. And sometimes those are junior people that are doing that. But it usually does have some kind of a leader who has connection into the executive branch of the organization that are really kind of leading the charge and who have visibility into what's going on in the organization to be able to say, hey, this strategy has changed over what we agreed upon. And do we need to go look at the portfolio? Because they're constantly thinking about that. So there might be, you know, one person at the top, but the analysts that are part of that and who are serving that up and who are helping with reporting don't necessarily need to be, you know, VP type level people or directors. So
yeah, that makes sense. You would think for the leadership position that some political savviness would be very helpful, right?
Because 100%.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, when companies are making cuts, you know, the PMO or the center of excellence is the first thing to go when it's the thing that you need the most.
Right.
in order to make hard decisions about your portfolio. So yeah. It's a little crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, I've seen the same sort of thing happen too.
Yeah.
I want to also address where portfolio management comes into play in organizations, right? So sometimes I've seen the topic of portfolio management talked about brought all the way into idea selection, right? And so like in my big perspective of product management, we have somehow this ideation thing's taking place, you know, at the very beginning. Somehow we're understanding what the customer needs. We have some technology we can leverage. We're trying to find a market for. We're doing something with an idea, some concept.
Yep.
And we're going to bring that into maybe do some business case work to figure out if it's viable, do an MVP, something to, you know, see if there's really a market there, if this will work. And we'll finally get to the point where we develop the product, make it real, and, yep. you know, do our maybe testing and get it out to the marketplace. And I have seen portfolio management discussed and applied all the way in the beginning in terms of selecting those ideas.
Yes.
And I'm personally uncomfortable with that, but I want to get your take on.
Sure.
I see this look.
Bring it. Let's talk.
Where portfolio management enters the stage gate, you know, perspective. So companies sure. doing stage gate. So.
Yeah. So I do believe that portfolio management as a discipline can enter the beginning, the front end of the funnel, if you will. And it is only, again, to provide that framework and make sure that things are on point. I really believe in Google's 10% time, but I'm not a big fan of zombie projects. And when you're doing ideation, it really should be challenge oriented. There's not a lot of blue sky type stuff. I mean, there is a place for that, but that's not a common thing. But using the ideation process to solve challenges. We need to take this product and make it 10% lighter. What can we do?
Right.
That should be an ideation challenge. We need to grow this brand. What products should we launch? That's an ideation challenge. So portfolio management is providing those categories and that strategy. And also that center of excellence is providing the framework to go make that happen. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of all brought together.
Yeah.
So I really do believe that there's a place for portfolio management in that beginning to really kind of define the structure side of it and the challenges to solve with ideation. I'm not a big fan of ideation for ideation's sake. It's sexy and it's fun and I love ideation. I am an ideation junkie in every single way, but I want it to have a purpose. And I think that portfolio management provides that framework and structure and purpose.
Okay, so in that example, okay,
bring me your side.
Here we go. Let's go.
Come on, let's go.
So in that example, I see good utility in using the portfolio structure, right? So maybe we have said, you know, 50% of our efforts are going to be incremental innovation, improving what we already know and using those improvements to extend what we sell to our existing customers, you know, deepen our impact in that market, as well as maybe try to grow that market. Perfectly fair, right? And you're using that to go back and then drive the ideation work that says, okay, well, how do we deliver on the objectives that relate to that strategy in our existing products, right? And then at the same time, there's this bucket for some tangential product areas, right, that we think
absolutely
we never pursued before, but we're hearing some, you know, holes in our product offering from our customers or our distributors, you know, that we think we could fill.
Or there's a new technology that's coming into play that how do we even leverage that? I don't even know.
Yeah. And so you're really connecting the mission and vision categories of the company, right? What are we about? And with the strategy that's set, and this is one of our problems in that many organizations, we just have the strategy is ambiguous, you know, and it's not filtered down properly. But let's say there's a clear strategy and you're using that to drive your portfolio and using that to drive your bets on ideation, right? So where are we going to spend our energy ideating around? I get that. That's good.
But?
I could get to a position where this is the right thing to do all the time. But on the other end, just ideation for the sake of ideation, I don't see blue sky thinking just taking place, right, in ideation. It's usually aligned somehow with people's interest in the context of what they're doing. Right. So you look at Adobe's Redbox program, right? Anyone can now become an innovator in the company. You just get your Redbox and follow the instructions, right? Do it, right? Love that.
Yeah.
Or Google, which apparently they're not doing anymore as they've grown. But
right. I heard that. Yeah.
They're 10% or 3M's 15%, you know, free time sort of thing. Those things help with culture as much as they do with ideation, right? And they help people, employees feel valuable and it's an incentive to keep making good contributions, right? But having that kind of off the map of portfolio frees up innovation in a different way, right? And that's one reason why I see more, you know, as you mentioned before, innovation incubators and labs, you know, being brought into things. And there, I think, needs to be some capability in the organizations to have this disconnect to say, I just want to ideate to pursue yep. things without any accountability to a portfolio and that reporting, just because that adds, in some sense, heaviness to what I'm doing, which takes away yeah. from the innovative spirit we also want to create.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that you can still do that. I find value in what you say, but at the same time, I think that those things can come together. Mm-hmm. I think that having that open space to be able to innovate and not having it tied to portfolio in any way, that there is a space for that, but it's earlier than kind of the traditional ideation for commercialization.
Yeah.
It's of the product concept. It is market trends that you're investigating. Again, it's that true R
right.
at the beginning. So I think we're both right. How do you like that?
That doesn't happen much, and there was no bloodshed in the process. That was great. And I would suspect, like Redbox with Adobe, that indeed there is an element of the portfolio that says, you know, we're going to devote this much money and resources to maintaining Redbox,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. That's maybe that 10% yeah. of breakthrough. Who knows?
Right. So, okay.
Because it's still resource time that you're allocating.
Mm-hmm. Good. So. Good perspective. Glad I asked. Glad we survived. So let's talk about mistakes.
Sure.
In setting up or managing a portfolio, where companies can get in trouble with this. One thing is it does provide structure and it can limit how we respond to opportunities, right?
Yeah.
I was with a company where, at least at one point in time, we had constraints over the size of companies we wanted to acquire. And there was a perfectly good company we wanted to acquire, but they were too small. It was simply, you know, it was a good fit, but there was, for some reason, this thing put in place in the portfolio for acquisitions, and they didn't make the cut, so we couldn't look at them, right? And so sometimes rules get built into place that we'd like to not deal with. What kind of mistakes do you see organizations running into, or what are some best practices they should be doing?
Sure. I totally feel you on that. I think that, you know, to address your point about, you know, the rules and the metrics and stuff like that, mm-hmm. I think that those, you have to be so thoughtful about that, those that they drive the behavior and the results that you want. When it discounts something that really would have been a good idea, that's where the human factor comes in, you know? And there is a human factor in portfolio management. It's not just a numbers game. It's right. not just how well did it score. That's why we're humans, and that's why we analyze the portfolio. And so I think that aspect is critical. One of the most common mistakes that I see is that they set up all of the structure and the process, and it becomes too rigorous. It's kind of what you were talking about with the constraints. I think that sometimes you get tempted to say, oh, well, we can do all of this process.
Right.
And then they just beat the living daylights out of innovation
right.
With process kill. And I think, honestly, I've talked to Dr. Bob about this, Dr. Cooper,
yep.
that stage gate processes sometimes are used for evil and
right.
not good. And it's why the company and the methodology sometimes get a bad rap. And, you know, being able to make sure that they are just enough portfolio process to accomplish the goals, and starting small and keeping it simple, that is the number one recommendation. I have seen it time and time again. That they do all of this process and all of these attributes and all of these reports.
Mm-mm. Right.
Amp it down a little bit and start with a blank slate and say, what do we need to drive the strategies that we want to be able to achieve and the behavior that we want to be able to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
And really starting from there, there's tons of best practices out there, but really keep it light.
Right.
And be very clear about what you're trying to accomplish with it.
Absolutely. We can make the project actually the process of managing the portfolio and kind of lose track of why we are managing the portfolio in the first place.
Yeah, I have one company that I worked with, and I was so excited to work with them. And we developed this great process and implemented the tool. And then we went into the portfolio meeting, and they approved every single project that went through the process. I'm like, you have missed the mark.
That was not what was intended. I appreciate the human element of this too. And this is very culturally dependent, and I think, unfortunately, not delivered on too much of the time, right? That processes get put in place and they get followed. So one of my colleagues was working for a company, and the project needed to be killed, right? There was clear market evidence that this was not to go forward. But the CEO, who does get to make such decisions, said, "We're going to do it anyhow," right? And later, come to find out that his bonus structure was tied to the number of projects that got through into launch, right? So it was just a metrics game. And there wasn't that human aspect, in that situation. There should have been the discussion with the board that says, "Hey, good faith, we did this. We got to a point where we recognize this should not go into the market. Now, I'm going to let it go into the market because you guys pay me a bonus for doing so. But I'm going to tell you, it would be better to restructure that bonus plan so that we save the resources of the company." But that human discussion doesn't usually happen, right?
It's a tough one. And you definitely, I think culture, talking about a common mistake, culture is critical. I mean, really being able to have a culture that accepts that. I'll tell you that in that transition from IT using portfolio management as a discipline and using technology, that's a harder thing because a lot of product development and innovating companies are so used to relying on gut and those guts paying off, those gut feelings. And, we get these amazing innovations and people like Steve Jobs. Can you honestly have a conversation about innovation and not mention Apple or Steve Jobs? I mean, it's just kind of a joke now. But it's like, people are afraid that portfolio management will take away that human aspect. And having a culture to say, I see the numbers that are coming out of the portfolio, but here's why I want to have a discussion. It's to elevate the conversation around all of this and to bring visibility to all of this so that you can have the discussion. And because one of the things that I see so happen when you don't have any kind of a portfolio management discipline or that single source of truth, is that you spend so much time gathering and massaging and smushing together and building PowerPoints around things that you don't get time to analyze. And that's what portfolio management is all about, is the ability to analyze and make decisions with confidence.
Yeah, because it is gathering the right information, right? Not just because we can gather information, again, not making this too process heavy, but gather the right information and then make decisions on that. So, and I'd love to dive into that more, but I want to make sure we're being respectful of everyone's time here too. When you're talking about, the larger organization and needing visibility into the portfolio across everything, surely there's tools that are making this easier for us. Companies using software tools, portfolio aids. What's available there? And obviously, I want to hear about what PlanView is up to also, since you work for PlanView, and what companies are using to add insights into portfolio management.
So, if you think about the entire commercialization process, I would probably bucket technology or tools into three categories. Number one is kind of the front end ideation, super sexy. We love it. Let's enter an idea and collaborate and vote. Type of front end mind mapping, all of those great things. So that's kind of, and those honestly get the label, which I think is totally weird, of innovation tools. Disagree, but that's kind of what it is, front end. Then there are the project and portfolio management tools, PPM, and that's what PlantView is. And they essentially start with the ideation, but also include the pieces of the investment analysis, the strategic alignment, the road mapping, the project execution, the resource capacity planning, the investment analysis, all of the changes, risks, and issues, managing the product catalog, all of the reporting, and the process, the stage gate, automating the stage gate and commercialization process. So that's PPM. And then kind of like down and to the right a little bit, if you think about the funnel, there's PLM tools. And that honestly is the technology that gets recognized the most in product development and innovation. So product lifecycle management tools. And that's the bill of materials, the CAD drawings, the product data management, the engineering. Let me pass this drawing from the mechanical to the electrical engineer, and some schedule management as well, and some resource management as well. And there's a little bit of overlap between the PPM tools with their project and resource management, and then the engineering tools in the PLM with their project and resource management. So those are the three kind of categories I would put as it relates to software tools in the space.
Big buckets, lots of offerings in each of those.
Yeah.
Let's focus on how PlanView helps with portfolio management.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Yeah, so we really focus in on delivering value in three basic ways. It's number one, being able to get greater value out of the portfolio. So same amount of resources, same amount of money, but higher revenue. We pick better. Like how to pick the higher value things instead of saying yes to everything.
Those three pie charts, make sure we have
absolutely
exactly.
That's right. The second thing is about improving time to market. Industry average is, you know, somewhere around 30%, and that's what our customers tend to see, is around 30%. We do have one customer of ours, CSM Bakery, who was able to automate their stage gate process in PlanView Enterprise and improve their time to market by 70%, which is unheard of. I mean, like I said, our average is about 30, and that's industry average, but 70% for them in what they were able to do. You can go to planview.com and, you know, click on the little search and type in CSM, and you can see their case study. It's really fascinating on what they were able to do.
Yeah, I might follow up with you on that, because I suspect listeners just heard that and said, that would be interesting to know more about. And so maybe we could do a CSM, get them involved and do an interview with them and ask what they're doing.
Okay. They're great. And the third value that we really deliver in PlanView Enterprise is really around decreasing cost. So really being able to eliminate a lot of the manual process and serving up those types of stage gate deliverables, and being able to get through the project faster because it's repeatable and because it's, you know, prompting people when they need to update their schedule or when they should take a look, like, hey, we've got a product that's going to launch late, that's going to impact revenue. What do we need to do? So it just aids on a lot of that, and being able to bring visibility to all of that so that you can make decisions better and faster.
Yeah. Adding visibility and transparency, you know, key things that make all this work, and add that human element to what we're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, it just eliminates all of the gathering and massaging. The data is there. Single source of truth. You know, you click in and see, hey, this is running late, or I need to proactively take a look at this, or I have a project that's not aligned to any strategy.
Right.
Should we be investing in that?
Yep. Good. For everyday innovators that want to find out more about PlanView, maybe look at some of those case studies, where should they
go? Yeah, you can just go to planview.com or email us at market@planview.com.
Okay, good. I don't know if you have any kind of trial, demo program, you know, call, find out more.
Yeah, we do have some demos that we can share, and lots of great case studies and research that we have sponsored about kind of the whole trend around product portfolio management as a discipline.
Okay. And in terms of just, you know, you're such a wealth of product management information across the spectrum, including portfolio management. For listeners that might like to keep track of what you're doing, I don't know if you do LinkedIn or how to make that happen.
You can find me on LinkedIn at Carrie Nayalis, and also on Twitter at PDPM Princess. That's PD product.
I like
portfolio. Well, you know, I'm not wearing my crown today, but it didn't fit with my headset. I tweet at a lot of the events that I go to, and anytime I find something really interesting, you know, try to share it out with people. So definitely follow me on Twitter, but definitely connect on me with LinkedIn. And if you do, please say, hey, I was listening to Chad's podcast. That's how I know you. Can we connect? I cannot stand that whole thing where you're just like, people connect with you, and I'm like, I don't know you.
Right. That's a good point. So at least you'll accept it if they say it's coming from the podcast.
That's right. If you're a friend of Chad's, you're a friend of mine.
There you go. or in the club. And as listeners are accustomed to, I always like to ask for an innovation quote. What quote did you bring for us and share why that one's important to you?
Well, it's funny because it actually ends up in every presentation that I give because I'm so passionate about it. And it's innovation is rewarded, execution is worshipped. It absolutely encapsulates what I believe and that, you know, that front end and the innovation piece is sexy and fun and it's creative and it gets a lot of hype,
right?
But the proof is in the pudding.
Right.
It's in your output and being able to execute, and you can't have one without the other and get innovation.
Right. You know, maybe to put it a little bit more crudely, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen. It's execution makes all the difference.
That's right.
So is this a quote we should attribute to you? Is this yours?
Oh, no. It's Danny Gilbert, I think, is who it's attributed to.
Okay.
It was hard to find, actually, who it was attributed to. I heard it at an innovation conference, imagine that. And I'm like, yes!
Very good. It's a great quote to end on. Carrie, appreciate your time. Thanks for walking us through portfolio management. And for listeners that want to follow up with you, I will put the links to your LinkedIn profile on Twitter in the show notes and make it easy to find the information also on PlanView. And we'll put in that pie chart too to kind of provide a good visualization of tracking a portfolio. Thank you very much.
Sounds great. Oh, thanks so much, Chad. Really appreciate it. Love talking to everybody.
Thank you for listening and for sharing this podcast with other product managers and innovators. Are you on LinkedIn? If so, and we're not already connected, please send me a connection request. Just search for Chad McAllister, PhD. Find the summary of the discussion with Carrie and the full transcript at theeverydayinnovator.com/084. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.